I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thanks to a trademark truck, which he really does drive, a five-year, little known till 3 weeks or so ago, state senator can claim that he is the elected man of the people in Massachusetts. Scott Brown closed his victory speech last night with these words.
I know I have a lot to learn in the Senate, but I know who I am and I know who I serve. I'm Scott Brown. I'm from Wrentham. And I drive a truck.
In a couple minutes, we'll take a look nationally to see how this election is reverberating. But first, we want to welcome to our studio two people here in the Boston area who have been watching it closely for quite a long time. Todd Domke, Republican political analyst, who joins us, as I said, here in the studio. Todd, I think congratulations might be in order.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
There you go. You know, we've talked quite a bit about what happened in this election. You've been weighing in it for quite a while. I want to touch on a couple of things. We've said this before on this program. This is not as shocking a turn of events. If you've been listening to many talk radio programs here in the Boston area, there are about 10 radio hosts, would you agree, here in town, justifiably claiming some credit for all of this victory?
Absolutely. I mean, they were giving Scott Brown a chance to come on the air, but more than that, the callers talking about him
and the host promoting
him.
And as we said, they have every right to it. There is no law against it. But our question today to you, Todd, what do you think this says about Massachusetts and the subsequent victory? Some Democrats are still shocked today. And by the way, we're going to get Dan Payne, who apparently has fainted, back on the phone with us. But some Democrats still are shocked because they never heard that radio. Is this state more balkanized than many people thought? Are Democrats more conservative than people thought?
Well, I think a lot of people didn't realize there is a certain wing of the Democratic Party that's conservative to moderate. They're not represented in terms of the candidates. Those are all liberals, all the ones who get elected. And there's been a shriveling of the Democratic wing, of the conservative wing. But they voted, and blue-collar, middle-class Democrats, especially out in the suburbs and rural areas, they came out for Scott Brown. Yeah. And I think that was shocking to a lot of the Democratic officials.
And I think we've revived Dan Payne, your good friend. Dan, you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, I wonder what you think about this. I mean, it's one thing for maybe some Democrats in the electorate not to hear this drumbeat over the last couple of weeks. But what about the Democratic Party not hearing it?
They in seem, Massachusetts or
yeah,
nationally?
Well, tell us what you think. In Massachusetts, start there.
Well, what happened simply to Martha Coakley is that she let her opponent define her and him. He called her a rubber stamp for Congress, who would raise taxes and coddle terrorists, and she didn't respond, and so the label stuck, and the terms then of the debate about this campaign favored Brown.
Well, and we've talked about this before quite a bit in the last week or so, especially about how Martha Coakley's campaign claimed they didn't have a lot of money. They had to run a primary, which she in essence didn't. They didn't have the money to do this. But again, they didn't seem to hear it. And you know, Dan, Democrats are waking up today saying, how did the Democratic Party let a seemingly nice fellow, but one who owns five properties, including a home in Aruba, and is against taxing Wall Street bonuses, portray himself as a guy in a truck?
I think it was overconfidence on the part of the Coakley campaign. And it's a good thing it happened so early in the political season, because Democrats across the country can now do their own assessment of their situation and what impact the health care legislation and a lot of these other issues is going to play. And they also need to understand that the Republican Party does exist. It exists here in Massachusetts, and it exists around the country, and it's going to make a case for itself everywhere.
And Todd, let's talk about that. You know, the shorthand, we want to get about a little bit beyond the shorthand, and as you know, the shorthand has been people are angry about health care reform. Yes, but let's go beyond that, because listen to this Rasmussen exit polling from last night. Health care was the number one concern among Coakley voters. More Brown voters thought national security was a big issue, 67% to 29%. Let's hear a little bit of Scott Brown last night. This is something you heard on the stump, on local radio stations. Let's hear him hammering away on that issue.
I believe that our Constitution and laws exist to protect this nation. Let me make it very, very, very clear. They do not grant rights and privileges to enemies in wartime. And the message we need to send in dealing with terrorists, our tax dollars should pay for weapons to stop them and not lawyers to defend them.
Todd Domke, a Republican analyst, could you put this in a little context for us?
Well, I think there were three main issues that helped Scott Brown. I mean, they all came like waves because they were all timely issues. The one was the Christmas Day attempted bombing. Mm-hmm. That's right. The idea of domestic terrorism and the idea of Scott Brown saying, no, they should not be given civilian rights. They should not be lawyering up, as he put it.
Which the Obama administration had just announced a trial that was going to take place in New York.
That's mm-hmm. right. And for a lot of Republicans, that was just a very emotional issue. They just couldn't fathom the idea. The health care bill in particular, with the Nebraska bribery of the senator.
Some would say it was a normal backroom deal. It happens all the time.
But that's part of the problem because the Democrats at the time, Harry Reid, said, oh, yes, this is normal. And most people were outraged at that he considers this normal. So that was another wave. The other wave was just the outrage about taxes and overspending, the deficit spending, the failure of the stimulus bill to really create job, double-digit unemployment. So those three issues really helped carry him.
Well, and staying with national security, Dan Payne, again, Democratic analyst, that national security showed up in so many of the polls, exit polls. You know, we remember, too, that in this area there was a man arrested in Sudbury, a town outside of Boston, charged with fomenting a terrorist act. You know, people were really jittery about all of this right before this sort of, campaign took off. Dan Payne, just quickly, the last thing that Scott Brown's supporters were chanting last night, one of the last things I heard them chant was, Kerry is next. What do you think the Democratic Party is facing here in Massachusetts?
Well, for one thing, they've got their calendar wrong. The next senator up is Scott Brown, because this term ends in 2012. But I do think that security and taxes have been longtime staples of the Republican Party. So there was really nothing particularly new about those two things being part of Brown's winning coalition. The health care bill, however, was not something they've been working to defeat publicly, except in the last couple of months.
But do you think, we're up against the clock here, Dan, and I'm just wondering, do you think this is a domino? Dominoes are falling? Do you think this state has changed as radically as the Republicans say?
I don't think the state has changed very much. Whether it's going to spread across the country, I have no idea. I do think incumbents should be jittery, and regardless of which party they're in.
That's Dan Payne, a Democratic political analyst. We've also been joined in the studio with Todd Domke from the Republican side. They're good friends. They usually travel together, and we thank you so much for doing it today.
Good to be with you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a look at the national fallout. Today, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said Democrats will press ahead with health care reform. Well, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said the election here in Massachusetts is a sign Americans don't want the government to take over their health care. Judd Gregg is a Republican senator from New Hampshire, the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. Senator Gregg, congratulations are in order to you as well.
Well, Robin, obviously, exciting day for Republicans in New England.
And a rare one.
Being from New England and from New Hampshire, it's nice to have a colleague from Massachusetts.
Well, let's talk about what this means on a national level. Late last night, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the health care reform bill will be passed. But today, Senator Jim Webb, Congressman Barney Frank have both said they don't think any votes on health care reform should happen until Scott Brown is seated. And Frank went so far as to say, I am hopeful that some Republican senators will be willing to discuss a revised version of health care reform. So do you see this vote in the morning light as a game changer?
I believe it is. I'm not sure Speaker Pelosi does. She's still living in San Francisco, I guess.
Well, do you agree that the health care system needs to be fixed?
Well, I strongly believe that it needs to be fixed. We need to address the issue of how we reimburse people. We shouldn't be reimbursing people for quantity and utilization. We should be reimbursing them for quality and value. Number two, we should address the issue of abusive lawsuits. That would reduce costs significantly. Number three, we should address the question of how you encourage people to live healthier lifestyles by giving employers the ability to actually incentivize people with cash payments to go out and participate in healthy programs. There are a whole lot of things like that that could dramatically improve the system and do not require that you go to a nationalized system.
Well, of course, Democrats would say it's hardly a nationalized system. A public plan is hardly even in it anymore. But
I would disagree with that fundamentally.
Well, obviously,
there's no question in my opinion that this is the precursor of moving down the road towards some sort of nationalized system, because you're basically going to drive out a lot of your private employers from supplying health insurance, forcing people over to the exchange, and then subsidizing such a dramatic amount of the population that you basically end up with a brand new entitlement, which will inevitably crowd out the private sector again, and you will, in 5 to 6 years, be in a position where basically you're going to be on the course towards a single-payer system.
What do you think the election of Scott Brown means for your party? He's more conservative than he might have been presented on the campaign trail. He's for waterboarding. He doesn't believe global warming is man-made. He's against taxes on bank bonuses.
Well, I don't think Scott Brown can be described as anything other than a mainstream politician in Massachusetts. He basically ran a fairly sound Republican platform of fiscal responsibility, national defense, and a belief in individual liberties. And that is what our party stands for. It's nice that we're getting our feet back underneath us. We didn't do such a great job over the last 8 years on the issue of fiscal responsibility, and we've got the opportunity to revisit that, and hopefully we'll do it better.
Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, the ranking Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, thanks so much for talking to us.
Robin, thank you for your time.
Let's turn now to John Harwood, chief political correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. John, I don't know if you just heard this senator from New Hampshire, Judd Gregg, saying that he felt Scott Brown was a mainstream Massachusetts politician coming to Washington. Is that what Washington sees coming their way? Oh, we don't have John, apparently, either. Well, let's see if we can get one of the two of them back on the line. There's John. John, you there?
I am here.
There you are. John, I'm sorry. I was just asking you if you had heard Judd Gregg, who just told us that he sees Scott Brown not as a conservative, as some are saying, and maybe even more conservative than he campaigned as, but he sees him as a Main Street Massachusetts politician heading for Washington. How does Washington see him coming?
Well, I think Republicans view him as an ally for stopping this health care bill, and Democrats view him as a symbol of the wave coming at them in November, a populist wave, and they've got to figure out, how do we surf that wave? Do we turn more populist ourselves? They could spend much of the next year metaphorically yanking out the fingernails of Wall Street executives, for example, in financial regulation and other ways of trying to cope with the unease that people feel about the economy. But the near-term calculation is going to be on health care. Do we kill it, and would that make us better off if we did? Do we stay the course, get the House to pass this Senate bill, have an accomplishment, and then go to the economy? Or do we try to reach some bipartisan middle ground? I actually think that's a fantasy. I don't think there is a bipartisan middle ground.
Well, you know what, John Harwood?
That's the choice they've got to make.
I'm going to hold you up there, take a break, come back and hear more Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about national fallout from the election last night of Scott Brown, a Republican here in Massachusetts. We've been talking to John Harwood, chief political correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. Waiting on the runway, we've got Gail Chadwick from the Christian Science Monitor. But, John, I just want you to finish a thought. You were saying that bipartisanship is a dream. And you actually got into some trouble with progressives a few weeks back because you said they should be happy with the Senate version of the health care bill, even if it doesn't include things they want, like a real public option, and does include things they don't want, like stronger restrictions on abortion coverage, because you say that's what's possible. They should lay off the hallucinogenic drugs. So what are you saying further to Democrats today?
Well, look, I think we've had a demonstration, and we had it in November, and we had it in the legislative process in Washington, and we had it in Massachusetts last night, of the limits of large initiatives. Big controversial pieces of legislation are hard to sustain in our political culture. The parties are polarized, the media is polarized. You kick up a lot of dust and make a lot of noise about particular issues, and it's hard to drive them through to the end. You've got people right now, middle-class people in Massachusetts, who concluded that this health care bill was going to take their tax money and insure a lot of other people with no benefit to them. Now, Democrats in the Obama White House will tell you that's not true, and that the way they built this legislation, both the House and the Senate bill, was designed to principally let people who have insurance keep it, extend insurance to the uninsured, but not levy a large financial cost or an impact on the quality of care for people who now have insurance. But people don't see that. It's
well,
hard to do.
They don't see it. They don't see it, but also the Democrats, at least here in Massachusetts, are being accused of failing to get that message out. You know what, John, I just want to bring in Gail Chadwick, again, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, I'm actually holding, and John as well, I'm holding the talking points that have been set out by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee to try to, you know, bolster other candidates across the country, telling them to stay aggressive and to make sure they lean towards these populist attacks on Wall Street that Martha Coakley tried to adopt at the end of her run, asking voters to choose between Republicans standing with Wall Street fat cats or Democrats trying to clean up a mess they inherited. But Gail, I mean, what they point out in the talking points is that's what Martha Coakley tried and it didn't work.
Well, the real problem they've got is that come 2010, they will have been the power in Washington for almost 2 years. It's one thing to use that argument when you're running against incumbent Republicans, but fair or not, it's now on their shoulders. The recession is, the jobless recovery is, all of the elements that go into making a bill like health care, the Nebraska purchase, the, you know, all of these little items that in a normal year are normal suddenly look like corruption. And you add that to the pain that people are feeling, and it's a very dangerous position for Democrats. And I think that going back to the playbook that helped them 2 years ago is not going to help them this time.
Well, John Harwood, you've been telling us what you think Democrats might consider, but what are you hearing? What are people saying today?
I think the dominant view within the White House and with the Democratic leadership is that members of the Democratic caucus are going to have to swallow hard and try to pass this Senate bill through the House. Not going to be easy. A supreme leadership test for Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and the Democratic leadership. I think that's what they're going to try to do. But, you know, it's a little bit unpredictable, Robin, because there's a lot of panic within the Democratic caucus right now. A lot of members are confronting the possible end of their careers and the huge political wave that Gail was just talking about that's heading their way. So no outcome is a certainty. I think that's the likeliest outcome at this moment.
Well, and Gail, you note that President Obama reached out to Republican Senator George Voinovich of Ohio yesterday. What did you read into that gesture?
I think it's a extremely interesting development. Voinovich is about to retire, has spent his whole career talking about fiscal responsibility. The Senate was supposed today be debating raising the debt limit. And this is an issue that I think the president can go to the public with the State of the Union and say, I heard the message. We're getting back to the reason you brought us to Washington. And one of them was straightening out this place and coming up with something tough in terms of fiscal responsibility. It's something that would reassure all these frightened marginal Democrats, the blue dogs, those who are walking into a guillotine in November. And he can put it off. It doesn't have to be right away. But as long as there is something like what he's discussing with Senator Voinovich, a commission, something that looks like it has teeth, I think that could be, in addition to whatever they do on health care, a very important next step to reassure their centrists.
And John,
Robin, I think Gail is exactly right on that point. I will say we can't lose sight of the fact that there are contradictory strains in public opinion. When people say they ought to focus on jobs and the economy, what that means in practical terms, if you're going to really do something to try to stimulate jobs in the near term, that means spending money. But at the same time, people are upset with how much money Washington is spending. That's not an easy thing to resolve.
Good point.
Well, and meanwhile, John, we're reading, you know, just as things come across, we have from Liberal Democrat Representative Anthony Weiner of New York. He says, I don't think it would be the worst thing to take a step back. We shouldn't be arrogant to get the voters' message. We also have this email just in from Tea Party Nation congratulating Scott Brown from Massachusetts and targeting their next candidate, Mark Kirk, who's running for Obama's old seat in Illinois. They say he's too liberal, and they're fundraising for the conservative running against him, Pat Hughes. So that should be cranking up even more. We've been talking with John Harwood, chief political correspondent for CNBC and a political writer for The New York Times, and Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks so much, both of you. And I'm sure listeners have thoughts. So we want to let you know we'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or leave a phone message, or scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. We'll, of course, continue to cover the reverberations from the Republican win here in Massachusetts. Meanwhile, a new poll from the Associated Press shows that President Obama is getting mixed reviews. Nearly 9 out of 10 people surveyed by the Associated Press, including 3/4 of Republicans, say they think President Obama is likable. But by a modest margin, people still said the country's moving in the wrong direction. In a moment, we'll go to Haiti, where a powerful aftershock sent panicked people streaming out of buildings this morning. But first, while I'm sure they would say it pales in comparison, there's still much concern in Los Angeles County, where police are asking hundreds of residents to evacuate their homes today in preparation for what could be the worst storm to hit that area in a decade. National Weather Service meteorologist Bruce Terry said the storm is one in a series this week.
One moved through yesterday, another one's going to move through today, yet another one tomorrow, and probably even one later in the week. So we have 3 more days of very heavy rains for much of the Central California and Southern California coastal areas.
As many as 5 inches of rain are expected in the next 2 days. And that's a concern for Deputy Police Chief Kirk Albanese of the Los Angeles Police Department. He's overseeing response to the storms for the city of L.A. Chief Albanese, what's the first thing you'd want people to know?
Well, the first thing we'd want people to know is to be mindful that the weather that is coming at us is significant, and so that the evacuation orders that we have given are designed for the safety of not only those people that live in those homes, but also the safety of emergency personnel that would be forced to attempt to get up there to rescue them should something occur, which, you know, we hope it doesn't, but based on everything that we know, there is a likelihood that significant runoff and debris will occur, and we don't want to expose emergency personnel unnecessarily to deal with those types of rescue issues if we don't have to.
We're already hearing of deaths in the region because of trees crashing down into homes and killing people inside, and you talk about mudslides. So just be more specific. Are the concerns of homes flooding or homes flowing off of high areas? What are your concerns?
Well, we have several canyon areas where some homes are more vulnerable than others. There are some homes that are directly in the path of the canyons, and in terms of the debris basins, some of those are near capacity. And so the rain that we anticipate today and the wind may exceed the debris basin capacity and certainly could send a wall of mud and in some cases take out a home. We have actually GPSed where that home, certain homes were or are currently. We hope nothing happens, but we need to have a starting point should homes that are in the direct path become subject to being destroyed.
Well, and we know you have another issue there, is that there is debris flow in some areas because those areas have been stripped of trees because of the wildfires in 2008.
And that's specifically the area we're talking about. You're referring to the station fire in the foothills above Tujunga or in the area of Tujunga. And, you know, specifically there are a number of different canyons. And these areas above them is where that fire occurred several months ago. The hillsides are bare, and so the risk is even greater because there's no vegetation to slow the path of the debris in the water.
Well, and we're seeing pictures here of SUVs overturned by strong winds. There were eyewitness reports in Orange County of boats lifted 50 feet in the air before slamming back down in the water, and also reports of a tornado in neighboring Orange County. Eyewitnesses say a possible tornado touched down on a building across from them, ripped off paper and insulation, ripped a skylight off. So whether or not there are actual tornadoes, winds are also a concern.
Winds are a great concern. And this storm that we're about to deal with, which is supposed to be the most significant, will be followed by yet another storm tomorrow. And so the ground is saturated. The area is ripe for the type of concern that we have in terms of the debris flow, which is why we asked 262 families to evacuate their homes to shelters until such time as we deem the area safe.
Deputy Chief Kirk Albanese of the Los Angeles Police Department talking about a series of really tough storms they're facing in that area. Chief Albanese, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And here are some stories we're following for you today. The country's top intelligence official says the Christmas Day airline bomb suspect should have been treated as a high-value terror suspect when his plane landed in Detroit. That would have meant questioning by special interrogators rather than civilian law officers. Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair told a Senate committee today that he was not consulted on whether the suspect should be questioned by the recently created high-value detainee interrogation group. And also in Washington, White House gatecrash Tariq and Michelle Salahi have invoked their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination in an appearance before Congress, looking to see how they got into the White House to shake hands with President Obama. We'll be back in 30 seconds. We'll go to Haiti here and now. In Haiti, the most powerful aftershock since last week's quake has startled hundreds of thousands of people already on edge and trying to recover. Just after 6 this morning, local time, the 6.1 tremor shook an area about 36 miles outside Port-au-Prince. It happened as international aid had just begun to gain momentum. Foreign forces have been dropping food and water from planes, and more medical supplies are coming in. The U.S. Navy hospital ship Comfort arrived near Port-au-Prince this morning. Well, that should be welcome news to medical workers who so far have been treating tens of thousands of quake victims with very limited resources.
I'll tell them to get it here. I can do that. Done.
That's Dr. Evan Lyon working at the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. He's a volunteer for Partners in Health, which has been in Haiti for 20-plus years. The Boston-based organization runs 10 hospitals there with 4,000 Haitian medical staff. Dr. Lyon has been helping out for the past 13 years. We caught up with him via satellite phone yesterday and asked him to describe the scene.
We're working around the clock to come back to life. We've been operating for 2 or 3 days now, but in improvised operating rooms without proper anesthesia. We've been forced to do amputations with a hacksaw bought from the hardware store. For the last few hours, we've begun to have electricity. Until then, we've been operating by daylight and by flashlight. I'm looking at a courtyard with more than 1,000 people that need urgent surgery to potentially save their lives.
More than 1,000 people?
In front of me.
Yeah.
Yes. So people with broken bones, people with compound fractures, they're getting antibiotics, they're getting wound care, but we don't have any pain medicines. People have been sitting with fractures, no pain medicines, infections starting to develop, and we simply have not had yet the capacity to take care of these people. The intensity of suffering, this name of your show, Here and Now, is really staggering.
Tell us a little bit more about these injuries, because we know many of them were crush injuries, and you can't even see them from the outside sometimes. So how are you handling that?
Well, the first thing we do when it's possible, if there's a crushing injury that's swollen tissue, we're obligated to do a procedure called a fasciotomy, where the skin and the muscle is opened to relieve pressure. It's incredibly painful under the best of circumstances, and here with a very small modicum of anesthesia and no post-op pain control, it's horrendous, but it can be life-saving. The biggest casualties, the people who are alive now, who have not died, and then there are more who have died than are living with injury, the people who are alive now, they have broken bones, they have these crushing injuries. If they've been lucky enough to not die of infection or kidney failure because of the crushing injury, they're here with us now, and we're working around the clock to provide them the surgical and medical care that they need.
Can you describe how they're handling that? I can't imagine being, a mother with a child, 500 people back in the crowd of 1,000 patient. How are they handling that weight?
Well, to be honest, I've lived in and out of Haiti for the last 13 years, and in many ways consider this my home. This country and this community and this city is handling this disaster in a way that I think few places on earth would handle it. We have these crowds. Just today, we're beginning to have some security from the U.S. Army. But up till now, it was my Haitian colleagues, the Haitian medical director, a few foreign volunteers, and we've just been here on the grounds, and we've been here working around the clock. People are very calm. There's no insecurity. It's been very painful to hear these rumors and lies about security problems when, in fact, I'm here right at ground zero and have been around the clock without any security issues. We've been circulating through the city in our own cars with our friends, our Haitian colleagues. I'm staying at a friend's house, and there's no insecurity. At night, there's no electricity. You can hear a pin drop in the city. I don't know how people are surviving, but they are.
Yeah. And what is it that you need the most? I'm sure you're aware from your colleagues back here in Boston that there's tons of money being donated by Americans. Things are being boxed up, but we know that there's a bottleneck at the airport. What have you started to get that you're appreciating, but what do you really, really need?
Yeah. What do we need right now? Right now, we need the ability to do surgery. We need surgical supplies. We need medicines, surgical medicines, IV medicines, and we need orthopedic materials, saws and pins, bolts, screws, things to repair the bones. We need material to do this acute work. Very soon, there's going to be now a generation of people with amputations, and so we need crutches. We will need wheelchairs. We'll need other ways to help people move if they've survived, to help them get on with their lives. Currently, many of our post-op patients are getting the best care we can possibly provide them. They're now 2 and 3 days without food, and they won't recover without food or water, and so we're working to get that. Right now, to be honest, what we need most is money. With money, we can move things very quickly. In the next weeks and months, it'll become clear what material is needed. But right now, we need cash so that we can move things into the country and deal with this as a disaster and a surgical emergency. Soon, there'll be other needs. Let me tell you another need long term, and really why I'm here personally. Haiti needs to rebuild Haiti. I am working as a volunteer directly for the medical director of this hospital. All of my efforts are at his command. This is a Haitian-led hospital. It always has been, and it always will be. We're providing assistance, but Haiti needs to be given the capacity to run itself. The urgent needs, the materials and the food and the water and the medical assistance is urgent. But in the coming weeks and months, when people start to forget about this disaster, we need to understand that this country has been changed forever, and it needs to be allowed to rebuild.
Is there any bright light that you want to share? Anything after 7 days of, just some hope?
I'll tell you, the greatest hope I have right now is with my Haitian colleagues and friends. They're unstoppable. The work that's been done to this point has mostly been done by Haitians. We're all deeply appreciative of the assistance that's coming in from the outside world. There's hope in that. And let me give you one positive story to end this interview, and then I got to go. You asked about crushing injuries. One of the things that can happen is with that muscle injury, it can overstress the kidneys. In these situations, people often need dialysis. And you'd think in these conditions I'm describing, it would be impossible to do something as technical and labor-intensive as hemodialysis. There's a team from Médecins Sans Frontières in Belgium that is here on the campus, and they've been doing dialysis now for 2 days. I got an email around midnight of someone in one of our hospitals about 70 miles away who was in kidney failure. They were moved here to Port-au-Prince today, and they'll receive dialysis. And those success stories will start to come, too. They'll be very slow, and they'll be very few, but there's some reasons to hope.
Dr. Evan Lyon with Partners in Health, speaking to us from the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Dr. Lyon, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And this last quick note, the House has just passed a bill allowing donations to Haiti relief efforts to be deducted from 2009 taxes. Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. A longitude is an imaginary line drawn from the north to the South Pole and back, not to be confused with a latitude, which is an imaginary line around the Earth. Knowing longitudes was important to the survival of early sailors and explorers, and to our next guest, painter and Williams College professor of art, Mike Glear. He traveled up and down one longitude, the one that goes right through his studio in upstate New York, to try to capture four different landscapes: the Arctic tundra on Canada's Baffin Island, the Amazon rainforest in the South American country of Ecuador, St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and New York City. 40 of those paintings, along with many beautiful photographs and thoughts from Mike's year on his longitude, have now been reproduced in a new book, Mike Glear, Along a Long Line. You can see some of his work at our website, hereandnow.org, while we ask him about it. Mike joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
We should say what a beautiful book. It's a coffee table size, just stunning. Why the landscapes?
I just feel that landscape is a very urgent subject these days. In art, it's been ignored for quite a long time, but with global warming and all, it seems logical for artists to get back to the landscape and come up with a kind of 21st century vision about it. And when I'm out in the landscape, I take in the color and I take in the motif, and it gets filtered through my own experiences and my own history. And it's a moment when one does not feel alienated from the world, but feels really a part of it. And I think that's a big issue in sort of the current environmental movement, is how to make people feel really connected to the land and intimate with it so that we are more likely to protect it.
I'm looking at this beautiful photograph. It almost looks Stonehenge-like. What is this structure, stone structure?
It's an Inuksut, and the Inuit would build them sometimes in the shape of a person or just a cairn, and they were for marking territory, stashing food, or as location markers if they're on the trail. But more interestingly, they'd build them in the shape of a window or door sometimes if they were homesick.
That's what this one is. It looks like the entranceway to something. It's got rocks piled on top so you could walk through this opening.
Yes. They'd build the window facing home, and then they'd sit in the window and project themselves mentally home so they could be with their loved ones when they were out hunting.
Did you go in?
Yeah. No, you could sit in the window and sort of, it is kind of magic to look through the landscape through this window of rock that they've built and imagine who they're thinking about in the great distance of the tundra.
Yeah. Well, meantime, as you're making your way around the globe, around your longitude, you came across people. I mean, just tell us some of the interactions, one family in particular.
Well, there are a number. I was thinking before we started this interview about a gentleman in the rainforest who was clearing the side of the road as I was painting. It was incredibly hot and humid, and the water was pouring down my face so badly that I could barely see to paint, and I had to put a wad of paper towels around my forehead just to work. And as I was struggling with this, this man appeared, dressed in long pants and boots and a T-shirt and a giant machete and a stick. And he started at one end of the road and, with absolute precision, bent over at the waist, kept the machete parallel to the ground, and started clearing the side of the road. And when he'd come to a big stick, he'd use his stick in his hand and he'd flip it with adroitly and continue on cutting. And he did this for about a couple hours until he got up to me. And what I was amazed at is he was working physically very hard, and he did not break a sweat. And he came back about an hour later. He cleared an entire mile of road. I was dripping, soaked from making a painting, and he cleared a mile of road without breaking a sweat.
You got to see other things like that where there was this naturalness. I'm thinking when you stepped on a grasshopper, which is sad, but then suddenly, boom, the forest's natural cleaning system goes into operation.
Yeah, it was terrifying, that part. I was painting, and I stepped back on this grasshopper, and I decided to see what would happen. And within half an hour, the entire thing was gone. The ants appeared, the grubs appeared, every part was sort of taken off, and just this little stain was left below me. And my experience in the rainforest was that I was constantly being poked and prodded to see if I was ready to be recycled into the biomass. And as soon as I showed weakness, I was out of there,
You could have been just a stain, reminder.
More comically, though, if you want another story, this is my favorite. I was painting, and a woman appeared out of no place, and she was carrying a brown sloth around her neck, hanging from her shirt. And she started to talk in Spanish rapidly, and she was pretty, middle-aged, buxom, with made-up eyes, and was being kind of flirtatious with me. And the sloth is sort of hanging, swinging back and forth as she starts to get even more animated with the conversation. And she wanted to communicate something to me, and I wasn't sure what it was. Finally, she started posing like Betty Boop, with one hand behind her head and one hand on her hip and, swinging her hip and head. And I figure out that she's posing like a model. That's why she has her hand on her hip and she's...
She wants to be painted.
She wants to be painted. She wants me to do her portrait.
And did you?
No. I was just doing the landscape.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, tell us about these pictures that I'm looking at here on pages 135.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in the Caribbean, yeah. There was this beach called Drunk Bay, which I found. It's kind of off the tourist path. And someone or some people have collected coral and rocks and debris from ships and created these very sometimes humorous but often scary human figures.
Yeah, they look like skeletons of humans.
And they're reclining across the rocks and perched in niches. At first humorous, but then after I spent time in it, I thought it was creepy and started to look like a scene of genocide. So I started thinking about the latitude that I was on, and I started looking at the news that was going on around the world at that moment on that line of latitude. And I saw that Darfur was actually on the line that St. John is, as well as Mumbai, and that was when Benazir Bhutto had been assassinated.
See how it works. You start thinking more and caring more. I mean, we can't think about the whole world, but you started being much more conscious of at least one latitude.
Yeah. I think it's a good maybe exercise for people just think about what's going on the side of the world right now.
Yeah. Well, last stop, New York City. And it's so fascinating looking at both the photographs and the paintings. You know, when we see you in the dense rainforest, we get this sense of these things rising above you. And in New York, you know, it's everybody says it, the New York is the canyons of New York. But we really see it.
Yeah.
So what's your sense of those paintings and photographs and where they fit on your longitude? Tell us.
It might be a bit odd to incorporate an urban landscape into this project, but I was trying to suggest that cities evolve by the same evolutionary principles as a landscape does. The challenge for me as an artist was trying to make pictures out of grids rather than from organic forms. And a grid is a little dull, so it took a while for me to figure out how to make a really interesting picture out of a grid.
Well, but ultimately, they do look like the huge rock formations up at the North Pole.
Yeah, and you know the color is similar too because the pole is full of those beautiful colors of granite and marble, and so is New York.
So you come home, upstate New York, and I'm, as you know, a lover of upstate New York.
Yeah.
But did it never seem smaller, or did it seem like, oh, I'm back where I belong on my line? How did it feel to you?
You know, when you live in a place most of the time, you begin to think the world kind of looks like your world. You sort of imagine it in the terms of your own environment. But in fact, every environment is very specific and very different, and that's what I've learned by traveling. So it's made me appreciate where I live and see its own beauty and see it as very unique and individual. But I no longer generalize about the world and see it in the terms of my own environment. I now see it as a place with incredible variety.
That's painter and Williams College professor of art Mike Glear, who traveled a mostly straight line from the Arctic to the equator to paint the landscapes along his longitude. His new book is called Mike Glear, Along a Long Line. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.